Rewind is a production of Wisconsin Eye. To keep programs like this free and accessible to all, please consider a charitable gift to wiseye.org/donate or text WISEYE to 44321.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, tax cuts and education, the two big ticket items the powerful Joint Finance Committee voted on this week. We'll break down what you need to know. Plus, a new lawsuit seeks to ban Elon Musk from handing out big checks in Wisconsin. And we look ahead to the state Democratic Convention with all eyes on who will be elected to serve as the party's next leader. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for June 13th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
I'm J.R. Ross.
After weeks of not knowing what Republican lawmakers' tax cut plan is, well, we got some answers on Thursday evening in the Joint Finance Committee. So GOP lawmakers on the committee approved a $1.3 billion tax cut plan that would expand the second lowest tax bracket and exempt the first $24,000 of retirement income for individuals 67 and older. Now, overall, the proposal would lower income taxes for about 1.6 million Wisconsinites. And now that we know the details of this, most of the details, JR, are not really surprising because they've been talking about the retirement income. They've been talking about targeting the second income tax bracket. So was there any surprise here when you dove into the plan?
No, the framework has been there since December. Robin Voss said in your interviews at 2024, I want a retirement income tax break. Devin LeMahieu said at the same time, we want an income tax-based tax cut. So we knew during negotiations with Governor Evers, they wanted this approach. The question is, I don't know the answer, is this the same size of tax cut they were talking about with Evers, or do they bulk it up because those talks broke down? The big question now is, will they get something from Evers? Now let's kind of jump ahead a little bit, but say this budget is finished as is and goes to Governor Evers. He's vetoed tax cuts before. Do either of these tax cuts put him in a position where he goes, I like that tax cut? He's vetoed a retirement income tax cut. Mm-hmm. He's vetoed an expansion of the second lowest income tax bracket. And now he might be running for re-election next year. Does either of those things make it more attractive to him to sign one? Does he do both? Does he do one or the other? Well, we'll see. A long way to go yet. Oh, by the way, they've also got to get a tax budget together that is conservative enough to get 17 GOP votes in the Senate and 50 in the Assembly. Does this fit the bill for what Republicans, those hardliners, are looking for out of this budget?
Right, and of course we still have a lot of other things to be taken up, like the UW system, mm-hmm. but there was education component to Thursday's meeting as well, which was the Department of Public Instruction, K through 12 schools. So JFC also approved $336 million for DPI that would largely target special education aid, which is going to be additional state money. Now, this, of course, is a fraction of the $3.3 billion that Governor Evers proposed for DPI. So this largely targeted special education reimbursements rate, and it will boost special education funding about $229 million. Evers had wanted, of course, a lot more. The special education reimbursement rate, Evers proposed raising that to 60%. Right now, it's around 32%. Republicans approved 37.5%. So that was a big discussion. Democrats very unhappy about it, but Republicans say, hey, we're still raising the rate, we're still giving more. So let's just hear from some of those arguments that played out during the Joint Finance Committee on Thursday.
So we have a unique opportunity to invest real dollars in the kids that needs the most services since 1996 and kids that we all care about. Budgets are about compromises, and even though we don't all get everything we want, we should still be able to all come together and move the ball forward in the right direction, and that's what this motion does. So I would hate for tomorrow's headline to be Democrats reject special ed funding, the highest rate since 1996.
Well, I want to correct the record about what the headline is going to be tomorrow. It's going to be, once again, GOP totally ignores the demands of the voters and underfunds public schools by about $1 billion. We're talking about shortchanging kids, not providing what they need, not giving them enough, to meet the needs of their kids.
Education is always a big focal point of the budget because Democrats and Governor Evers always argue for more. Schools want more. They need more. Republicans have had the same argument, too, against that. It's like, look, we're increasing funding. We're still doing a little bit each time. But, you know, not everyone's always going to get what they want.
So remember, there are kind of several components to the whole education piece of this. So you have general school aids. Those are equalization aids. They go to districts basically according to how wealthy or poor you are. There are categorical aids, which includes special education, per pupil payments, those kinds of things. Then there's the revenue cap, which limits how much you spend between the state aid and the property taxes. The governor extended for four centuries an annual increase in that spending cap of $325 per student per year. Okay, so that's locked in, barring a change in state law. The focus in this motion was on those categorical aids with special education. The governor wanted 60%. That cost $1.1 billion roughly to meet that mark for reimbursement. The biggest pot of money, general school aids, they didn't put anything, not a single dollar into that. I thought that was fascinating because that's been the main vehicle for doing school aids for years. Now, the Republicans have moved away from the pot of money based on how wealthy or poor you are versus according to your property values, especially because up north, for example, if you're in a lake community, you can have really high property values, not be a very wealthy community. They've gone more toward a per pupil increase of payment that's separate. Anyway, what I'm watching for is this enough for the governor? Because he's the education governor. You're not delivering on his main priority of putting more money in education. Remember, $3.3 billion with a B versus $336 million. The other piece of this is we have a lot of money to spend. I talked about this before, $4.3 billion for a surplus. That's one-time money. Everything you put into education, into tax cuts, are an ongoing expense. And then put you into a possible hole for the next budget. Because remember, if you make commitments into future years, like a tax cut, or raising the base level of funding for education, you have to cover that next biennium. We have another thing coming up next week, the week after, Medicaid. Right now, cost to continue, just covering the program as is, $1.6 billion. We expect $1.5 billion of revenue growth in this two-year period. That's important because if you just did Medicaid with the current revenues, took everything else away, we still have a small structural deficit because it costs more to cover Medicaid than we have money coming in, our base level of funding for the next biennium. All this stuff is going for that structural deficit. That's important because there are members of Republican caucuses like a Steve Noss, for example, at Whitewater, who that number is very important to. The bigger it is, the more heartburn he has. There's a sweet spot there for Republicans of where do you land that doesn't give your own members heartburn about like your future spending commitments. Right? It's kind of the whole piece of the puzzle there. This thing, every time you push a little here, it's going to pull a little there. They've got a ways to go, but they're getting closer to what this thing's going to look like and what that final picture fiscally for Wisconsin would be under their budget.
Right, and we haven't heard from Governor Tony Evers on how he feels about, of course, the tax cuts and education funding. Of course, Joint Finance was late into the evening yesterday, but we do know all of these votes happened after the negotiations broke off between Evers and GOP legislative leaders. He was asked earlier in the week on Tuesday about how those negotiations went, and Evers insisted that he didn't lie when Republican legislative leaders refused to meet his demands to make significant investments in education during budget negotiations. Now, this comes after Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said on Sunday that Evers' team lied when he suggested that Republican lawmakers refused to agree to those meaningful investments. Now, Evers also disclosed that the two sides were very far apart on boosting special education funding, as we just laid out in the last topic. But I think what this all could mean is, you know, like we mentioned, is Governor Evers going to sign this? Is he going to agree to it? Is he going to try and veto it? We know Republicans are trying to be very careful in how they craft the entire budget document so he doesn't use that powerful line on and veto it again.
So governor said in Green Bay, it's not my DNA, right, to veto this. He wants to sign the budget. We should be able to get to an agreement. We're adults here. But he's the education governor. So is this the red line for Governor Evers of you're not meeting his demands for education? Ergo, he can't sign this thing. That's a question for down the road. He's threatened before, but never really come close to vetoing the budget. And I'm also going to be fascinated to watch this plays out. How Republicans put this thing together because they know he's got a very powerful veto pen. The Supreme Court has not tried to rein it in the lawsuits we've seen so far. So they got to be very careful how they craft this thing, what language is in there, to avoid fodder for him to make changes.
Right. All right. Well, let's also now recap Tuesday, because Joint Finance, of course, took up many other agencies as well. One that we do want to highlight is Judge Security, because there was a proposal out there that Governor Evers wanted that would create a new enforcement agency to protect judges. Now, this marked the second time that the committee declined such a proposal, despite requests from conservative state Supreme Court Chief Justice Judge Annette Ziegler. Now, other actions by the committee included the Department of Workforce Development, DAC cap, and insurance as well. But this one was a little surprising, I think, to me, but it is the second time that it's happened in a row. And the argument that we've heard from Republicans is that, you know, right now, Capitol Police does secure the building, does oversee justices that serve on the bench, and they say, well, that's suitable for now.
So what's interesting is that right now, Governor Evers, he has wide latitude with federal COVID-19 funds. He's put those dollars into four positions that are helping provide security for the court. Those jobs will go away, I believe, in September of this year or next. So that's going to be no longer there. The question is, can Capitol Police pick up the slack? And oh, by the way, Republicans aren't big fans of the Supreme Court right now. The liberal majority has not really been friendly to them, I guess. Don't know if that's a motivation for this entire thing, but something to keep in mind, that they're not exactly on the same page about a lot of things at this point.
And the security issue also was very heightened after there was a murder of a Wisconsin judge back in 2022, of a Juneau County judge. So that kind of spurred and there's been multiple threats, I mean, on the rise, not only at the state level, but national level, threats against judges and justices. All right, let's move on to another big story this week, which deals with billionaire Elon Musk, because a government watchdog group did file a new lawsuit on Wednesday seeking to prohibit Elon Musk from ever again offering cash payments to voters in Wisconsin. If you remember, he handed out two big $1 million checks to voters and also had a petition that if you signed it as a voter, you would get $100. The lawsuit filed by the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign argues that Musk and two groups that he funds violated election bribery laws, and they're asking the court to order that Musk never offer similar payments to voters ever again.
So we've seen legal challenges before. They haven't gone very far. Go back to Pennsylvania. Musk did something very similar there. Lawsuits weren't successful. Before the Green Bay rally, the days before the April 1st election, Josh Calder went to the Circuit Court, Appeals Court, State Supreme Court, trying to get an injunction to prevent him handing out $2 million checks after he did $1 million to another guy up in Green Bay to be a spokesperson for the petition. Court said no. So I don't know what this might break for new ground. What's interesting, though, is that this push, they're trying to, like, say, don't do this again. We don't want you doing this kind of thing. You're opening up the election to being bought off. Now, the question is he paying voters or to vote or to be registered? I know it's a slight nuance, but for the petition, you got $100 for being a registered voter and signing a petition against activist judges. You weren't technically rewarded for voting. The law says you can't bribe somebody to vote. You had to give your address, your physical address, your email address, your name, your phone number, which you can use to turn somebody out to vote in an election. So it's obviously a ploy to get people to turn out. But again, it was not to vote. It was to be registered and sign a petition. Okay. The rally, originally he said, this is a thank you for voting. You can get in if you vote, and I give in $2 million checks to reward people for voting. Then he took that down. Probably the lawyer said, hey, Elon, you can't do that in Wisconsin. And it turned into, again, if you sign the petition, you can come, and the extra checks will be for people who signed the petition. Is that enough of a difference to have it to be kosher? Also, there's a unique argument here about he created an illegal lottery. So you can't have lotteries for the heck of it in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. That's a state-run thing. And you have gaming with the tribes. But they created a lottery, essentially, with this. We'll see where it goes, filed in Dane County, so it'll take a while to figure it out.
All right, let's move on to our another topic this week, which is going to be previewing the state Democratic convention, which will be this weekend in the Wisconsin Dells. Of course, this convention will be different than many years past, JR, because they will be electing the next leader to serve their party. Of course, Ben Wickler, who is currently the chair, will be resigning at this weekend, and they will elect between these three individuals. You have William Garcia. He is currently the La Crosse County Democratic Party chair. You got Devin Remiker, former state party executive director, who is endorsed by Wickler, and then Joe Sopecki, who is a Democratic strategist. Now, I sat down with Ben Wickler to discuss what we can expect and what he thinks about leaving his footprint on the state Democratic Party. So let's take a listen. So much for joining me to preview what is to come this weekend at the state convention. And this year's theme is the road to 2026. So what can people expect?
This is going to be a great convention. The national situation at this moment is somewhat terrifying. You know, Trump is sending troops into California. He's got a military parade in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow. There's so much chaos. But at the same time, there are so much energy for people who believe in democracy, who believe this country should work for working people. And across Wisconsin, we saw that energy in the spring Supreme Court election when Susan Crawford won in a landslide. So when Democrats gather this weekend for our state party convention, we'll be cheering on the speakers, from the state legislators to congressional leaders to statewide elected officials, and then from Governor Evers to our keynote speaker, Senator Raphael Warnock. We'll be electing my successor, the next state party chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, and there'll be so much time for people to train, to connect with each other, to really map out what they can do this year to prepare for next year's Supreme Court election and the fight to win a trifecta in the state of Wisconsin.
Now, of course, you guys are still celebrating a big win in April that maintained liberals' majority on the state Supreme Court with Susan Crawford's victory, but it comes after a disappointing November. So how does the party get back on track and move forward?
Well, the critical thing after November was to learn as much as we could, as fast as we could, and then apply those lessons in the spring. I think it became very clear to us that you need to connect with voters in a communication fashion that is everywhere all the time, online and offline, in rural areas and cities and suburbs. And you need to define what the race is about. This is something that I think the Trump campaign did pretty effectively. And I think it was a challenge on the Democratic side, because it was such a short campaign last year, to really establish what the fundamental stakes in the election were. This spring, I think we sent a clear message as a state. And the Crawford campaign and the party and all of our allies made really clear this was about corruption, a system where the richest people in the world could buy Supreme Court seats, could get whatever outcome they wanted, versus integrity and making sure that every person had a fair shake. And I think what we saw with Susan Crawford's victory was a recipe for the kind of work Democrats can do this year and apply next year going forward to win at every level of the ballot in 2026.
Now, as you mentioned, of course, this is a very different convention because you'll be electing the next leader of the state party. Now, there's three people vying for the job. What are your words of wisdom for the next leader?
So I think the key thing in Wisconsin is that we never shut down. Our strategy is to organize year-round and organize in every zip code, in the reddest areas, the bluest areas, and the most purple. This is something that doesn't happen in a lot of states. It's something that I don't really see from the Republican Party here. But we organize our county parties and our neighborhood teams to go door to door, to keep offices open, to make phone calls, and learn, connect with voters, listen to people who have not supported us in the past, to find out what they care about so we can meet them where they are and make the case that Democratic candidates have more to offer. That and the other piece is to stay on offense in terms of defining the fight. Right now, we have a state budget negotiation that'll determine whether the state invests in K-12 education, in childcare, and in supporting the university system. This is something where Republican legislators need to hear from their constituents. We have the same fight happening nationally, where Trump is trying to take away healthcare to fund a massive tax cut for the ultra wealthy. And at the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, we are loud and proud about what those stakes are and how we're on the side of working people against those trying to rip them off. I think the next chair has an opportunity to carry that forward. I've endorsed someone who I've worked with very closely, Devin Remiker. Devin helped, he actually wrote down the plan. He architected the strategy to go after Elon Musk in the Supreme Court election. So I've seen firsthand how he does this so effectively. It's up to the voters at our state convention who they're going to vote for. And I think we're going to have a great convention and a great free and fair election at the conclusion.
Now, I bet a lot of people are wondering who can be the next mega fundraiser, because that was a huge centerpiece as you as chair. I mean, you set the record or set the bar very high. You were able to fundraise a lot of money. How does the next leader, I guess, take that Rolodex that you're leaving behind or carry that momentum to keep the fundraising level so high?
The key thing that I think has been essential to our fundraising has been that we've earned people's trust, that we can use funds effectively to go out and help win elections. So the strategy has been to explain what we're doing, to be transparent about the fact that we do organize year-round. We don't just save up for the final stretch and then, you know, hire a bunch of people in the final 3 weeks. To go out and show our data, show the impact of the work that we do. Even when we lose, there's a lot to learn. And when we win, you don't want to just say, oh, everything was perfect. You want to keep learning from that and innovating. I think, you know, with Devin, he has the opportunity to say, he actually helped run and was our executive director. He led that work. So that trust about our program can continue going forward. And I'll be here to help. I'm excited to introduce the next chair to folks who've been supporting the party. And there's hundreds of thousands of people who've donated online, grassroots donors, who I think are looking to see the Democratic Party carry forward this tradition of both constant engagement and innovation and meeting the moment. I remember when the COVID pandemic hit, we had to switch gears totally. We'd been so focused on door knocking, now it was all going to be virtual. It was actually Devin who wrote down the plan on a napkin that he still has about how to switch gears to focus on absentee ballots with virtual organizing. But because we were able to pivot, we were able to go out and say to the world, this is our strategy. We need funds to help us do it. And if you support us, it can win. And that's exactly what happened in 2020 and most elections since.
And what's next for you? Are you maybe considering running for higher office? We know that you recently ran for DNC chair at the federal level. But what's next for you? What's in the future?
I think it really does matter who's in public office. I think that public service is a sacred trust in a democracy. I could see running for office someday, but right now I'm really excited to spend time with my kids. I started chaperoning field trips as the school year wound down, now that I'm not running for re-election as WISDEM's chair, and I'm working on a book proposal about the lessons that we have in Wisconsin about how to fight back against control by far-right Republicans that try to attack things that benefit all of us in order to benefit a handful of people at the top. This is the kind of fight we've had in Wisconsin. I think we have the same fight nationwide.
Now, at the national level, there was recently a messy feud that came to an end with DNC leadership. Want to just get what you take away from that, and what do you think the party has to do to unite the base going forward?
Well, the fundamental issue, I think, in the conflict at the DNC is this question about what is the party's role. And the way we do it in Wisconsin, it's in our Constitution, is that the party is neutral in primary campaigns. The Democratic Party's job is to defeat Republicans, to unite Democrats and try to advance our core values, the idea that every person deserves respect and dignity and freedom, and the idea that this country should work for working people and not just those who already have everything. The National Party has the same kind of neutrality. And you know, there was one vice chair who had a project, an organization that took sides in primaries and tried to get involved in, you know, defeating some Democrats over others. And ultimately, I think there had to be a choice between that kind of intra-party fight or a focus on uniting Democrats to then take on Trump and MAGA and the Republicans. I think going forward, there's always room for debate, for renewal, for change. That is part of the democratic process. I think the party's job is to build the infrastructure that can allow the general election candidate to succeed.
All right, Ben, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck at the convention this
weekend.
Thanks
so much. Really
grateful. Take care. All right, we obviously talked about the chair race, but we also want to mention the other leadership that will be on the state Democratic Party, leading with Sarah Godlewski. She'll be the first vice chair, Joshua Taylor, second vice chair. Kim Butler will be the secretary, and Randy Udell as treasurer. Of course, the star under Butler and Udell indicate that they are incumbents. So it should be a lively convention this week, and especially Sunday when they vote for their next leader. All right, let's get to stock picks this week. Rising is tourism.
Yeah, so annual report out, up again, $24.8 billion, up from 24 the year before. 114 million people voted, traveled to Wisconsin. So interesting, you got to think big things last year, RNC convention. Some places had the biggest overall spend, include Milwaukee and Waukesha County. No shocker there, because they're the biggest counties in Wisconsin. Mostly day visitors. We're not a place you go, like I said, for a week if you're out of state, but that's what coming in. I'm watching for next year, the draft in Green Bay. What kind of a bump do we get out of that event up in Brown County?
All right. Mixed this week is the co-chairs of the Joint Finance Committee, because we just touched on this a little bit, but it's all going to come down to how Republicans can get the sweet spot of 17 votes in the Senate, 50 in the Assembly. That usually, you and I both know, they don't want to rely on Democratic votes, but the Senate is a very different dynamic this year, of course, under the new legislative maps.
And it's a compressed window. They waited, you know, they were holding out hope of a deal with Evers, right? That fell apart, so now they've got a shorter window. Now, They can get it done on time. Remember, at home, there's no big deal if the budget's not done by June 30th, end of the fiscal year. Things went as is. But it's a symbolism of being done on time. So expect long nights in finance next Tuesday and Thursday, probably at least one day the week after. Okay, no big deal. We burned the midnight oil in that room many times. All right, fine. But can they get to that sweet spot where the budget's conservative enough to get 17 votes in the Senate, 50 in the Assembly, and put Evers in a difficult position where he feels compelled to sign the budget? Remember, he's never vetoed a budget before. He's threatened a few times, especially for education funding, never gone through with it. Is this the time that they do that? No. Sign up the governor, he could veto a tax cut, done it before, and in the back of his mind could go, you know, if I win in 26, if I veto that tax cut, I've got this many dollars coming in that I can, you know, can set aside what I really want to do in 2027. That's a long ways away. The governor, though, education governor, is this going to really give him heartburn to not have money in general school aids? Now, Mark Bourne, co-chair of the Finance Committee, during the hearing Thursday night said, look, with property taxes, there's going to be $1 billion in new money for schools, $1 billion. The state's only doing $336 million. Republicans, one, there's still a chance, Barm talked about this, they might do some more about property taxes down the road. The debate about going on right now with Republicans. If they don't, they're taking a gamble. That gamble is that when you get that property tax bill in December, if this budget, as is, education becomes law, and you go, man, my property taxes went up, that's Governor Evers' fault. Republicans have been obsessed, and I mean obsessed, by your property tax bill for years. The Walker years, that's almost all they cared about sometimes. Oh, yeah. They are saying, we're going to do a budget that has a higher property tax bill than what the governor's budget was going to do. I would never have guessed to have seen that. But in their minds, this is Evers, because Evers had that veto on 23-25 to increase that per pupil spending limit. Now, one question I have for the governor, if he's thinking about vetoing this thing, is what's the difference between getting $336 million and nothing? So if he vetoes the entire thing, there's nothing going into the formula at all, right? This formula of state aid and property taxes. Yeah. $336 is not a whole lot of money. I mean, I hate to say that because it's $300 million.
Right, but when you spread it across the board.
5.5 million people, his properties. It's not a huge difference between that. Why wouldn't he want to hold out for something a little more impressive from education? Oh, by the way, if they get a budget out of finance that gets through both houses, what if it only gets through one house, not both of them? What if the Senate's okay with it, the Assembly's not? What if there's an amendment going back and forth? Lots of things up in the air, but these guys are now in this position right now, Bourne and Mark line, getting a budget done, compressed window that maybe puts Evers in a tough spot. It's a lot to get done, but there's a light in the tunnel right now.
Right, and just beyond the budget too, there's still, you know, discussions. Could there be trailer bills? Could there be other bills to, you know, get Democrats happy enough to vote for the budget if they know something else is coming? I mean, it's just going to be a fascinating dynamic to watch out for in the coming weeks. Falling this week, conservatives, kind of a broad topic, but we're talking about Bradley, who might not run for re-election
now. Remember we talked a few weeks ago, I was picking up rumblings of like more kind of doubts among conservatives that Bradley would actually run. She told me after the April election, she's going to run for re-election in a 10-year term. She's going to take some time to figure out how to win, because it's another disappointing April for conservatives, right? Liberal Susan Crawford won by 10 points. Mark Belling, a sort of talk show host in Milwaukee, put out something this week saying that he's hearing from his sources that Bradley's unlikely to run, no decision made, but the calculation is it's just too tough. I made some calls, hearing some similar thing that more of a tone for my sources of the conversations with Rebecca Brother now are kind of discouraging about her running because of the reality of conservatives don't do well in spring elections anymore. Now, whether she runs or not, the fact you're having this conversation tells you how bad it is for conservatives. This is an incumbent female justice who is a favorite of the Federalist Society. The fact that she is having second thoughts about running should tell you how deep the hole they are in. She is their ideal candidate in a lot of ways to run for the seat. Now, you could argue with Chris Taylor, who is very liberal, fourth district court appeals judge out of Dane County, that maybe a moderate conservative, kind of more in the middle, would be good for you. But as far as like lighting up the base, Rebecca Bradley does it. So if she's not going to do it, what's that say about the election next year? And oh, by the way, Belling's tone in his column was almost like, we can't win. And that really came across to people of, that's only a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you don't believe you can win, how do you win? Now, Next steps, Republican Party of Wisconsin is going to have a postmortem out sometime in early July about what went wrong this April. We know what the answers are. Trump voters. How do you turn them out? Trump on the ballot. One of the problems or calculation for Bradley is Brad Schimmel embraced Donald Trump fully, right? Daniel Kelly in 23 kept arm's length. They both lost by 10 points. It doesn't really matter what you do. Now for Bradley, something to think about is if she doesn't run, what do you do? There's speculation about the Seventh Circuit Appeals appointment in Chicago right now. She's 53. At 51, it pains me to say this, but she's too old almost for that job because the Trumps want people in their 30s and 40s for those appointments. So she has a challenging path ahead of her, regardless of what she does. Oh, I forgot. I've got one addendum to the stock report this week. Could you see this? They're going to pull up the screen for us.
Oh.
So we want to wish you well, Emily, your new path, your new career. So it's not a rising, mixed, or falling. It's a
I was just going to say.
super rising. How's that?
Yes. It is my last show here at Rewind. It has been a fantastic 7 years covering the Capitol and a little over 3 years doing this show with you, JR. It's been an amazing ride. I'm moving on to a very new territory, new chapter outside of news, but I'm also very excited for this opportunity. I wish the show and you continued success, and I will miss you viewers at home. So thank you so much for watching every week and catching up with all your week in politics with me and JR. It has been a pleasure and an honor to work here. Thanks so much. I'm Emily Fannin signing off for the last time.
And I'm JR Ross.
Take care.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, Your Week in Review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.